funneled tens of billions of dollars in weapons to Chinese Taipei since 1949 to purportedly help it maintain its autonomy from Beijing, even after officially acknowledging the island as part of China and severing formal relations with Taipei in 1979. As U.S. President Joe Biden recently presses Congress to approve another $1.1 billion in weapons and military support for Chinese Taipei, experts from Chinese Taipei and mainland China agreed that no amount of American pledges or aid can make Chinese Taipei secure. Only cross-strait peace can do that. Thus far, in his administration, Joe Biden has sold $1.06 billion in weapons to the island, meaning the proposed deal would more than double the military aid that Joe Biden has given Chinese Taipei. The move comes weeks after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Chinese Taipei and met with senior leaders on the island, despite warnings by Beijing and the Pentagon alike that it would be provocative to do so. Several other U.S. lawmakers have followed suit, and the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, held massive war exercises and drills all around the island in response. Professor Wang Yiwei, director of the Institute on International Affairs at Beijing's Renmin University in China, told Sputnik News, "Actually, the United States should be worried about a military confrontation, a conflict, or even war with China. But the Americans will lose face after Nancy Pelosi's visit and China's very strong response, which we saw during the military exercises and drills." Professor Wang Yiwei noted that U.S. foreign policy is driven gradually by the military-industrial complex, causing it to swing from supporting a long-term confrontation with Russia in Ukraine to conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, to selling weapons to Chinese Taipei. He said, "America has bad and even failed governance domestically, and then asked the world to pay the costs. They're playing with Chinese Taipei card. They even want to copy the Ukraine model in the Taiwan Strait. It's not because they can't find any consensus domestically, but only to sell weapons, only to target China or bash Russia." The website of ABC News has explained more about the same story. China's foreign ministry charged the United States with violating its commitment to the One China principle and interfering in the internal affairs of China recently, after the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee approved a new bill that could significantly increase American defense support for Chinese Taipei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning told reporters in Beijing that China had lodged serious complaints with Washington over the new legislation, which still needs U.S. House and President Joe Biden's approval to become law. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said, "The One China principle is the political foundation of China-U.S. relations. If the bill continues to be deliberated, pushed forward, or even signed into law, it will greatly shake the political foundation of China-U.S. relations and cause extremely serious consequences to China-U.S. relations and peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait." Under its One China policy, the United States recognizes the government in Beijing while allowing for informal relations and defense ties with Taipei. It takes a stance of strategic ambiguity towards the defense of Chinese Taipei, leaving it open whether it would respond militarily where the island is attacked. The Chinese Taipei Policy Act of 2022, approved by the committee recently, sets out to support the security of Chinese Taipei and its right of self-determination, providing billions of dollars in defense funding to enhance its counter-intervention capabilities. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez, who co-authored the bipartisan bill with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, claimed that its focus is on deterrence and that China should not see it as a threat. The committee's approval of the bill comes at a time when tensions between Beijing and Washington were already high over Chinese Taipei following the recent visit by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taipei.
The Persian language in India.
Part 1.
India is a nation with a history and culture that goes back 3,000 years before the birth of Christ. It's a strange land in Southeast Asia where 1.2 billion people live and practice numerous religions. India's 3,200,000 square kilometers shares its borders with Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, China, and Burma. India abounds with natural beauties from the Himalayan plateau, the Ganges and mountainous regions, to plains, forests and deserts with various weather conditions. The national flag of India is a horizontal rectangular tricolour of deep saffron, white and Indian green, with the Ashok Chakra, a 24-spoke wheel in navy blue at its centre. India Gate, Qutb Minar, Humayun Tomb and Taj Mahal can all be found in the city of Agra, 70 kilometers from Delhi. Indian culture is brimming with elements of Iranian culture and civilization. Every inch of India's vast expanse bears witness to that. In the buildings and structures, in the manuscripts and libraries, and even the streets. For about 800 years, Farsi or Persian was the language used by Indian royals and people in administrative positions.
I'm Hassan Zaidi. I was born in Iran, but my mother and father are Indians who immigrated to Iran. At the moment, I'm a student at university. I study social communication science. For my thesis, I decided to seize the opportunity to do some research about history, civilizations, architecture, and the Persian language. What comes to our aid in our research is not just the literature we find in libraries, but the general atmosphere of the streets, the people's traditions and culture, historical buildings left to us from past generations, and the art forms that this ancient land has to offer in every street and alleyway. It seems the Persian language is what the people of India and Iran have in common. It's what brings them together. The last 800 years show that the Persian language's influence over India has affected many elements of everyday life for its people, giving it a Persian hue.
History tells us that Farsi came to India around 800 years ago, especially to its northern regions, influencing the social dynamics of India as well as its politics, economy and culture, particularly in the earlier of those 8 centuries. Its effect was so profound that from then on most of the country's cultural, religious, political, literary and administrative texts were written in Persian, as were all personal and government documents, including judicial decrees and the like. For centuries, this land fostered and cultivated the Persian language. Thank you.
We have a very famous quatrain from the famous Iranian poet Muslihuddin Saadi Shirazi. He says, all mankind are actually part of one body. And if one part aches, the other part also gets affected. And we have got the famous hadith, according to Islamic sources also, from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He says, "Kullana min Adam wa Adam min turab." He says, all of us are from Adam, and Adam is from clay. That means all mankind have got a single root. And if you look into history, this is all, the Iranians and the Indians, they're actually very close to each other. Some thousands of years back, maybe some 3,000 years back or more than that, there were migrations, waves of migration from Central Asia of the Aryan race. One branch came and settled in the Iranian plateau, and the other branch came to North India. And they had the same tendencies, they had the same culture, they had the same actual religion and ideology and the same ethnicity. And in course of time, because of the geographical factors, there might have been some separation between them. And there was an independent evolution, those living in the Iranian plateau and those living in North Indian plain. But actually, since the roots of the people, of the race were same, there has so many similarities and commonalities.
History has several explanations as to how the Persian language found its way into cultures so far afield. One is the immigration of Iranians to other lands, some of them caused by war and upheaval. Thus it was that Farsi became the language of science, wealth, religion, and power in India. It was during the time of the Indian king Humayun and the Safavid period in Iran that many people emigrated from Iran. Humayun, who ascended to the throne with the help of Iran's Safavid king Tahmaseb, welcomed Iranian scholars, poets, and scientists to India. Among the poets that went to India, some of them ending up in the royal court, were Zahiri Naishaburi, Ghazali Mashhadi, Talib Amoli, Kalim Kashani, and Halim Lahiji. The emigration of Iranian traders, cultural figures, and scientists to India was the most influential element in the spread of Farsi in that country.
India has been a center of Persian studies since the last, say, 700-800 years. And you see, initially it was mystic literature which was brought to India, and that created really a great impact on Indian psychology, where, you know, the poets, the authors, philosophers, all of them, in fact, combined together, got together, putting heads together, and he started writing on, Indo-Persian ethos. And therefore, you see, a large number of mystics we find in India, in every nook and corner of India, and they really created a very good atmosphere of learning Persian language and literature.
Kings fond of the Persian language were in power in India. Their support for Iranian scientists and poets helped the language take root in that country, where it soon would become one of the nation's official languages.
There has been quite a lot of influence from Iran to India. There is up to 1850s, quite last century, Persian was a court language in India. So if you see archives or documents which India, they are in Persian language. So the till the kings and whoever came, they had an Iranian lineage. They came from Iran.
The effects of the Persian language on Indian culture are very apparent. This can be seen clearly in the country's language, literature, architecture, and art forms. There are few cultural or scientific institutes in India that do not display signs of Persian influence in poetry and verse alike. In universities and colleges across India, there are more than 50 Persian language departments hard at work, and more than 100 schools teach Farsi as part of their curriculum. In most traditional and Islamic schools, students study Farsi texts and are familiarized with the works of the great Iranian poets like Sa'di, Hafiz, Ferdowsi, and Khayyam.
Some of the Iranian poets have been very popular amongst the Iranians, see. Take, for example, Omar Khayyam. Omar Khayyam has been very popular in India, and we have so many Indian Omar Khayyam as a result of the popularity of Omar Khayyam in India. And what we see that a great scholar and poet of Hindi literature, Harivansh Rai Bachchan, who wrote Madhubala, Madhushala, and Madhukalas, you see, they are all, people say that is a second version of Khayyam's Rubaiyat. Now, apart from Khayyam, Nizami Ganjavi is also very famous, in fact, like, you know, Khamsa Nizami, and Amir Khusro writing another Khamsa. So therefore, Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, Hafiz, and Sa'di, and Jami, you see, later on, you see, all of them have created their own methods and their own place amongst the hearts and minds of the people of India. For instance, you see, if you go to the southern part of India, you will find a number of Omar Khayyams in Tamil, Telugu, Malayalam languages. Why? Because, you know, the kind of poetry Omar Khayyam rendered in Persian.
But the manuscripts written in Persian that can be found in libraries across the country bear witness to the spread of Farsi across this great nation down the centuries. There are very few buildings that have not been embellished with Persian calligraphy, and very few libraries that do not hold Persian manuscripts. The head of the Persian Language Research Center in New Delhi supports that claim.
A stroll along India's streets and a quick glance at some of its buildings show just how much the Persian language meant to its people, and still does today. Silent slabs of stone and placards tell the tale of Farsi's spread across India. The Taj Mahal that belongs to the 16th century has many a Persian inscription. Farsi has been used to inscribe the graves of those who inspired and built the Taj Mahal, portraying the marriage of the two cultures most elegantly. But apart from the Taj Mahal, there is the Humayun tomb, another masterpiece left behind by an Indian royal. The affection Indian royals had for the Persian language is apparent here also. By using Farsi in their architecture, we see how the language was inscribed on their hearts as well.
Major was the architecture, in fact, you see. The Iranian architecture is seen everywhere, you see, with the combination of Indian architecture, you see. Like Taj Mahal, you see, you cannot really think about any architecture by ignoring Taj Mahal, in fact. And similarly, you see, all the forts, you see, which we find in India, they are testimony to the Iranian architecture. Similarly, you see, the paintings and the calligraphy particularly, you see, if you see the type of calligraphy developed by the Iranians in India, with the help of the Indians, you see, and the interaction between the Muslim world and the Hindu world, in fact, you see, so they really, it's a wonderful combination.
Persian dictionaries written in India have helped the proliferation of the Persian language. This in itself shows how dear the Persian language became in that country, and how towards the end of the 15th century, the Indian people cherished Persian words and phrases maybe more than Iranians themselves. 12 Persian dictionaries were compiled in India from the 15th to the 17th century, and the archives of Indian universities and literary institutes are full of Persian texts. Thus it was that with the spread of the Persian language, the Persian or Iranian culture crept into the lives of the Indian people. The bond became so strong that it went beyond the physical aspects of life to the metaphysical. Besides affecting India's economy, political and social makeup and culture, it influenced the people's faith as well. These changes can be seen from the moment Farsi entered the culture to this day. It was with the help of Farsi that Islam managed to enter India and come to be known as a liberating faith alongside others.
There is definitely a connection because Islam came to India through channels. One of the most important and all-pervading channels has been the Persian channel. That is the people, the civilization, which was created there with Iran as its center and whole Central Asia part of that very civilization. Iran, when I talk of Iran in Persian, this is not the present geographical Iran. This is the Iran of Central Asia, because Central Asia was part of that Persian civilization. And Islam came to India largely through the channels which were created by the Persian Islamized civilization. So we had the people, the scholars, the saints, the scientists, all of them, they used Persian as a language of intellectual discourse as well as a language of the academic language. And there were Muslims ruling India for almost 800 years, and court language was Persian. Then again, Islam's main sources, primarily in Arabic. Then after Arabic, the most important work which was done in any other language is Persian, whether it is in Tafsirul Quran, whether it is the Sharah of Ahadith, whether it is Tasawwuf, whether it is Ilmul Kalam, or whether it is philosophy, and also even scientific works. We have scholars like Al-Biruni, who wrote in both, in Arabic language as well as in Persian language.
When I think about the connection between Farsi and India's history, I'm convinced that in order to understand that history, we must travel down the path of language, the Persian language. The language manuscripts and ancient texts are written in, the language poetry was versed in. Farsi, which embellishes ancient structures and was the means of communication between governments and the people down the ages, the language traders used to communicate in strange lands, the green treasure of India.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian Voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A German think tank has warned that Europe's largest economy will face a recession next year, and a reduction in Russian energy supply will increase inflationary problems in Germany. The Institute of Economic Research, a German think tank, warned that the German economy is expected to shrink by 0.3% in 2023. The cut in the supply of gas from Russia in the summer and a significant increase in the price of this product harmed the recovery of Germany's economy after the coronavirus pandemic. Also, the real income of German households and purchasing power in this country will be greatly reduced. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian writes, last week, the Munich-based Institute of Economic Research slashed its prognosis for German economic growth, declaring the country is heading into a winter recession. It forecasts Europe's largest economy would shrink by 0.3% in 2023, after growing by just 1.6% this year. Inflation is forecast to hit 8.1% this year, and 9.3% in 2023. Timo Wolmershauser, the Institute of Economic Research's head of forecasts, said the cuts to gas supplies from Russia this summer and the drastic price increases they triggered are wreaking havoc on Germany's economic recovery following the coronavirus pandemic. Timo Wolmershauser added, he did not expect a return to normal until 2024, when 1.8% economic growth and 2.4% inflation could be expected. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is travelling to the Persian Gulf in the coming days to secure supplies of liquefied natural gas, LNG, from United Arab Emirates, as Russia chokes off its gas supply to Germany. A recent survey has shown consumer confidence to be at its lowest level since the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1949. Faced with higher energy bills, German households are rethinking spending, from holidays to household purchases and meals out. Businesses are doing the same, avoiding new investments and instead holding crisis meetings about how low they can reduce heating in factories and offices. Increasing number of companies are switching their workers into Kurzarbeit, short-time working mode, which was first introduced in the 1920s in response to the economic crisis in the Weimar Republic, and later utilized to considerable effect during the global financial crisis. This willingness to cling on to workers is seen as crucial if Germany stands a chance of emerging from the current crisis. But increasingly, the question is being asked, how long will it be able to afford to do so? The website Politico explains more about the same story. Germany's Bundesbank said in its monthly report on Monday, 19th of September, that Germany is heading into recession as inflation is set to top the 10% mark. The report said there are mounting signs of a recession in the German economy in the sense of a clear, broad-based and prolonged decline in economic output. The central bank projects a moderate contraction for the current quarter and more pronounced declines in activity in the final quarter of this year and the first quarter of next year. The Bundesbank, the German central bank, said high inflation and uncertainty with regard to energy supply and its cost affect not only the gas and electricity intensive industry and its export business and investments, but also private consumption and the service providers dependent on it. The Bundesbank did not offer any specific numbers and cautioned that the outlook for the Eurozone's largest economy remains shrouded in uncertainty. The industry-heavy German economy is very reliant on Russian gas, making it particularly vulnerable to the fallout from the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. At the same time, the report said inflation is seen accelerating further and coming in at double digits in the coming months. The British newspaper The Financial Times sheds more light on the same issue. Investors are now more pessimistic about the German economy than they have been at any time since the Eurozone debt crisis more than a decade ago, worrying that a sharp fall in Russian natural gas supplies and soaring energy prices will plunge the country into recession. The ZEW Institute's gauge of investor expectations about Europe's largest economy has sunk to its lowest level since 2011, dropping from -53.8 to -55.3, underlining the deepening gloom about the economic fallout from Russia's special operation in Ukraine. Economists have slashed their estimates for economic growth in Germany and the wider Eurozone this year, while raising their inflation forecasts and warning that an end to Russia energy supplies would force Berlin to ration gas supplies for heavy industrial users. According to the European Energy Exchange, German baseload power for delivery next year, the benchmark European price, rose over 5% to a record €502 per megawatt hour. This is six times higher than the price a year ago, driven upwards by the sharply higher cost of gas used to generate electricity and a prolonged European heat wave that has disrupted generating capacity in Europe. According to data from Eurostat, the European Commission's Statistics Bureau, the surging price of energy has driven up the cost of imports for Germany and other Eurozone countries, sending the bloc's trade deficit up to €24.6 billion in June, compared with a surplus of €17.2 billion for the same month a year earlier. The value of exports from the bloc rose 20.1% in June from a year ago, but imports were up 43.5%. Michael Schroeder, a researcher at the ZEW, said the still high increase in consumer prices and the expected additional costs for heating and electricity are currently having a particularly negative impact on the prospects for the consumer-related sectors of the German economy. Michael Schroeder said investor sentiment also worsened due to the expected tightening of financing conditions after the European Central Bank, the ECB, raised its deposit rate by 0.5 percentage points to zero in response to record levels of Eurozone inflation. Carsten Brzeski, head of the macro research at Dutch Bank ING, said the German economy was quickly approaching a perfect storm caused by high inflation, possible energy supply disruptions, and ongoing supply frictions.
Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today we are going to explore Iran's handwoven carpet market. We wanted to see why these carpets are highly coveted and what makes them so expensive. Plus, we will look at some of this sector's contributions to Iranian culture and the national economy. So, stay with us and let's roll out the show. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Handwoven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most handwoven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the U.S. sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy. But the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the U.S. imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic, hand-woven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of handwoven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of handwoven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation. We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities, because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety. Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety. For most companies in the food industry, the high quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meatpacking companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, These harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured. The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy. First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here for the first time on Bazaar. The process that we are checking out today is called plating. Well, it's not actually called plating, it's just very similar to plating. I just thought that that's the name that you had heard. It's actually called PVD, or physical vapor deposition. But it's similar to plating in that it's essentially adding a layer of metal on a material, maybe to harden it, maybe to for decorative purposes, but mostly for decorative purposes. So this is the process that we're checking out today in this edition of Bazaar.
The company we're checking out today started their journey by producing microelectronic parts, such as vacuum pumps, vacuum tubes, pressure sensors, and the likes. But they quickly realized that a better way to implement the tools that they're manufacturing is to actually use the parts to assemble a machine to do coating in a much more sophisticated way rather than selling the individual parts. They found a much better market making those machines and getting clients to coat various objects and materials in their machines, or even selling the machine itself to clients so they can run a coating business themselves.
So the application can be used in tiles and ceramics, faucets and other kitchen and bathroom appliances, kitchen utensils, bowls, also kitchen utensils, and decorative items such as these three vases and also crystal. Now, the different colors are achieved using different combinations of titanium. If it's a combination of titanium with nitrogen in the form of a gas, you get the gold-looking color, which is applied on crystal, has this kind of matte texture to it. And the rose gold color is a combination of titanium, nitrogen, as well as aluminum. The black one, well, the shiny black one, is a titanium, nitrogen, aluminum, and carbon. So, and of course, the last one, the crystal, which has this like tint of rose gold, it is achieved using a completely different material, chromium. But now let's talk about the some of the processes that went behind to get this company to this place that they are able to make these items.
Here's how the process works. Once the objects we want to coat are loaded into the chamber, blocks of titanium are loaded onto the cathodes. The anode is the entire chamber itself. Through small holes in a pipe inside the chamber, argon, a neutral gas, is injected. Argon is the preferred gas for the process because it doesn't chemically react with either our titanium block or the loaded material. At this point, the chamber is turned into a vacuum chamber to allow for the gas to flow more easily in it. The argon is ionized, so it moves towards the cathodes that have the block of titanium on them. And it moves at such a speed that it vaporizes the titanium. And now the titanium in the gaseous form is ready and primed to sit on our material in the chamber, especially since the particles of the material have expanded due to high temperature in the chamber, making it easy for the titanium atoms to go and sit in between the particles and stick to it easily after they've been taken out of the chamber at room temperature after cooling down.
When you see the zapping, that's when the titanium atoms are sticking to the surface of the chair, or when the coating is happening. It's the physical deposition of the vapors, as the technical term suggests. But there is one missing link here. So what we put in the chairs that we put inside the chamber, they had a silver, an unappealing silver tint to them. And now when they're going to come out, they're going to have a gold coating on them. But here's the thing, the missing link is that the titanium block can only give you a silver shine, right? But the gold shine is not just with the titanium block. If you want to get the gold shine out of it, you're going to have to add nitrogen into the mix too. So through the same pipe that the argon is injected into the chamber, nitrogen in the form of gaseous is also injected into the chamber. And that nitrogen, once it is connected, once it reacts with the titanium, you get that gold tint. And now they're going to open up the chamber. So they were waiting for the air pressure to come back to a stable level because there was vacuum in there. And if they just open up the chamber when there's vacuum in it, that's not going to be good. So there's the gold tint on your silver chairs. And the gold, of course, is the combination of titanium and nitrogen. There you go.
In every part of the world, decor takes a different shape. What people spend money on to make their houses look good is different. Gold has always had a special place in Iran, which makes it understandable that we, perhaps more than the average person in a lot of other countries, would like to have ornaments that have that shine, just without breaking the bank.
Us humans love shiny things. We tend to value them more highly than their non-shiny counterparts. But, you know, gold tends to be a little bit more expensive than, titanium or pretty much any other metal. So because we can't have something this big that is made out of actual gold that shines, we do the next best thing. We coat it in gold, aka titanium and nitrogen. Personally, though, I prefer things to be more matte, but that's just personal preference. But obviously, there's a market for these shiny ornaments and furniture and candlesticks. So whether it's a gold shine or a silver shine that you're looking for, I think now you have a much better idea of where these things get their shine from. But anyways, thank you for staying tuned for another edition of The Bazaar.
We're getting close to the end of the program, but before we go, let's take a look at some news and trends in the country's carpet and textile industry. Persian handwoven carpets are some of the world's oldest, most valuable rugs, but watch out, there are scores of counterfeit ones too. That's why these carpets are registered with the World Intellectual Property Organization. The head of the National Carpet Center, Farahnaz Rafe, says Iran's handwoven carpets are registered with the WIPO badge. Rafe describes the global registration for handwoven carpets as a move towards preserving and protecting this original art industry. These rugs will now be exported with the WIPO badge. Also, other ways to spot an authentic Persian carpet are through its handwoven knots, which are tighter and more delicate. Another method of identifying authenticity is the choice of materials like wool and silk used in the carpets or by pinning down its regional design. In other news, Iranian artisans have hand-woven a unique rug in anticipation of the famous FIFA World Cup event this year hosted by Qatar. The carpet's intricate design incorporates flags of participating World Cup teams and top figures from the world of football, as well as information about Qatar. The master weavers are two brothers from the city of Tabriz. They say they used 70% silk and the remaining a combination of wool and silk. The carpet was created with over 2 million knots, measuring roughly 2 square meters, and was woven in 34 months. The work of art was unveiled during a ceremony in Qatar's capital city, Doha, earlier in the summer. It will be displayed throughout the competition for all to see this October. Carpets can be breeding grounds for all sorts of unwanted allergens, so Iranian scientists have created a special nano antibacterial coating for carpet fibers, which has become quite popular recently. These carpets use a material containing silver nanoparticles, which can kill over 600 types of bacterial species. The antimicrobial protection prevents the growth of mold, dust mites, and other allergens. Originally, these types of carpets were released into the market roughly 3 years ago and are currently exported. In 2019, exports of antibacterial carpets stood at $2 million. These items are mainly sent to neighboring countries, Russia, South Africa, and some in Europe. That covers our program for today. Thanks for tuning in this week. It's bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Though the Western media ignores Sapra and Shatila massacre by the Zionist regime years ago, but the scale of this event was so vast that it cannot be